Spotify.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Seeking Justice program on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Denny Griffin. For the next hour, I will be co-hosting the show along with Kim Colton. Kim, good evening.
Hi, Denny. It's nice to be here.
Glad you could join me tonight. And if I sound a little hoarse, folks, I am. I'm fighting a cold here, but I'm going to give it the old college try. And I'd like to start out, but we have a special edition show tonight, and it's a special edition in that we aren't going to be profiling a specific case. And we do have a guest that I'm very anxious to, I have some questions for myself, and I'm sure a lot of other folks will too. And I'd like to introduce Dwayne T. Bowers. Dwayne is a traumatic loss therapist, an educator in private practice, and the author of Guiding Your Family Through Loss and Grief, and A Child is Missing, Providing Support for Families of Missing Children. As an educator, Dwayne teaches seminars nationally, internationally, and regionally on dying, death, and grief, as well as trauma, PTSD, and traumatic loss. He has served as an adjunct professor of counseling at Trinity College in Washington, D.C., and has been an invited guest lecturer for graduate and undergraduate classes at the University of Maryland, Howard University, University of the District of Columbia, Johns Hopkins, George Washington University, and Gallaudet, I believe I'm pronouncing that right, University. As a therapist, Dwayne's specialty is working with survivors of traumatic death and suicide, which includes assisting families who must identify loved ones at the D.C. Office of the Chief Medical Examiner through the Wendt Center for Loss and Healing. He also provides support to families of abducted, missing, exploited, and murdered children through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Dwayne serves as a training consultant to NCMEC and is deployed by them to provide crisis intervention at Amber Alert sites with Team Adam. He also serves as a consultant trainer for Team Hope, a telephone support line for parents of missing children, and has provided services to AMICO, or AMICO, Association of Missing and Exploited Children Organizations. Dwayne, welcome to Seeking Justice.
Thank you. Thank you, Denny. Thanks for having me on. And hi, Kim. How are you?
Hi, Dwayne. I'm great. And thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, first of all, just some general questions. I don't even know where to begin. I've got all these questions rolling around in my head, and I'm not sure which is the first step here. But what are some, let's talk about trauma. Let's talk about what makes an event traumatic.
Good question. You know, you can have two people go through the same event, and one person will be traumatized and one will not. The difference is how that individual subjectively interprets the event. And so each of us uses our upbringing and our values and our experiences to make that interpretation. One of the things that you can almost always count on, though, is if a person had trauma in their childhood, some kind of a traumatic event when they were young, whether it might be sexual abuse, physical abuse, whatever, then when they're exposed to a trauma as an adult, they will immediately fall into the same pattern of behavior because we form neural networks in our brain which kind of cause our behavior to be the same when we're triggered in a similar way. So trauma is a biological reaction as well as an emotional reaction, and the biology of it includes sort of the middle brain and your limbic system. And, of course, the emotions of it is the terror, the horror of the event, the fear, and the other emotional reactions you have to the event. So you can't just treat the emotional aspect of trauma. You have to also treat what's happening in the body, the establishment of the neural networks, the whole limbic system response, all of that to do a complete intervention for trauma, and that takes some time. So that was a long answer for a short question. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. So let me just get back to what you first said. So you're saying that when you are exposed when you're younger to a traumatic event,
mm-hmm.
And when you experience another traumatic event when you're older, you'll fall into that same pattern,
mm-hmm.
meaning that you will, I'm not sure what that means, meaning you'll act the same way you did when you were younger, or?
Yeah, let me clarify that.
Yeah.
When you're exposed to a traumatic event as a child, and this can be as early as 2, 3, 4, you actually form neural networks in your brain which cause you to, the way your brain responds to it, it becomes a neural network. So that means that your chemistry will be the same, your internal chemistry, your limbic system will be the same, and that includes the release of cortisol, which is one of the big hormones in a traumatic response, and it affects the whole body and the brain. So you will go into the same chemical reaction, and then your body responds to that chemical reaction. So a child who was traumatized by something at 4, let's say, and now they're 20 and they've never been triggered again, and a similar situation happens to them, and their heart beats faster, and they get this overwhelming sense of fear, and they just want to run, they just want to hide, and they have no idea why, because their body is reacting to the current trigger in the same way that it did to the original trauma. So that's what I meant by that, and mm-hmm. that's one of the early things that you ask about is, you know, did you have earlier trauma? Because it helps you to understand why they're reacting today the way they are to certain triggers.
Okay. And I have a question from the chat room, and I'm not sure they can hear me, though, so they can clarify this question a little bit more. But does every child have a trauma in his definition? Oh, in your definition, does every child have a trauma? Well, that's a good question, because a lot of things can be traumatic for a child.
Absolutely, but I would say no. I don't believe that every child has a trauma. I think, and understand, there's a difference between saying that I am traumatized and experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. That's PTSD. Saying that I am traumatized. For mental health professionals, let's back up. For mental health professionals, we have a definition of post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a set of criteria that have to be met for us to make that diagnosis. But there's no set of criteria for a diagnosis of trauma. So that's kind of a loose word. So people by their own definition may say that they've experienced trauma, but not necessarily from a mental health perspective. And so you're kind of walking on thin ice when you ask a question like, does everybody experience trauma? If you ask them, they may very well say, yes, I experienced a trauma, da 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 da. But from a mental health perspective, we may not see it as that. So from my perspective, no, not every child does not experience trauma earlier in life.
Okay.
I hope that text or that person in the chat room, if they have more questions, if I wasn't clear, I hope they follow up with that, because I want to be sure they understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Believe me, she will if she didn't understand.
Okay.
She'll let us know. Okay. First of all, I've heard of the fight. Flight, but I've never heard of the freeze response. I've heard where people say, well, it's either fight or flight, mm-hmm. but I've never heard of freeze. But that's interesting.
Actually, mammals have three possible reactions to a traumatic event: fight, flight, or freeze. And all mammals share this in common, because we all have a limbic system, we all have a hormonal system. And what fight does is if we choose to fight in the situation, then we'll stand up to it, we'll fight the oncoming thing, or we'll see it through to the end, whatever that means. Flight means we run from it, we try to get away from it. Freeze means that we just freeze. Now, in animals, the freeze response was play dead. And animals do that all the time. There's a type of goat that you see on the Animal Channel every once in a while, that this goat, if you scare it, it literally freezes and falls over, and it stays rigid for like 30 seconds. Well, that's a freeze response. And the freeze response protects us because we don't move. Let's say you're walking through the woods and a bear comes out of nowhere. You can stand up to it and shout at it and try to scare it away. You can run from it, or if you're like me, you'll freeze out of fear.
Yeah.
And so that freeze response is so that if I don't move, maybe he'll get distracted by something else. If I play dead, maybe I won't be interesting anymore. So it is a natural response that we have, and there may be times that you can think of that a event happened in your life that startled you or scared you, and your first response was you just sat there. You just couldn't move, even if you wanted to, mm-hmm. and that's the freeze response.
Okay.
And it is controlled by hormones.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, this is just so interesting. And it's so true, too. In fact, I was just scared the other day. I didn't hear my son come in the front door. And when I walked in there, I turned around, and I just out of the corner of my eye saw a man standing in my house. And before my brain could even register that it was okay, it was him. I was looking right at him.
Mm-hmm.
But I was screaming the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just frozen with this scream and in my head knowing that it was him. It was kind of weird how that whole thing happened.
Your limbic response, actually, your fear response, which is controlled by your amygdala, which is in your brain, actually you have two amygdala, they respond 100 times faster than your thought process, which is in your cerebral cortex. So you're going to scream, you're going to scream long before you have the thought, oh, that's my son. Because you're having a fear response, and that's usually as a result of cortisol flooding that area of the brain, of the amygdala.
Interesting. We have another question in the chat room,
uh-huh.
and I guess I kind of jumped around a bit, but the fight, flight, and freeze response are not indicative of PTSD. It isn't go hand in hand with PTSD, does it?
Actually, it does. And if you go through the definition of PTSD, if you go through the criteria, it breaks into three parts. One is re-experiencing, one is avoidance, and one is hyperarousal. Well, there you have it. The avoidance very often is seen mm-hmm. as the flight response. Hyperarousal, you have to be hyperaroused to flee. If you look at the specific criteria, your number one reaction to the trauma must be either extreme horror or intense fear. So that's mm-hmm. going to cause you to either fight, flight, freeze. But it's hard to see it. And most people, when they think of PTSD, they think of the reaction that soldiers have coming back from war and that sort of thing, which are the long-term symptoms, which are more along the lines of having re-experiencing the dreams, the nightmares, the flashbacks, the hyperarousal, not being able to sleep, easily angered, those kinds of things. So most people, when they think of PTSD, they think of those longer-term reactions. Now, here's the thing to think about. Fight, flight, freeze is my immediate reaction to the event. When the event happens, I will either fight, flight, freeze. You cannot get a diagnosis of PTSD until at least 4 weeks after the event. That's one of the criteria. It has to be 4 weeks from the event. So mm-hmm. When I say flight, fight, freeze, basically what we're talking about is the initial response, but there are still elements of it that can carry on into the diagnosis. I bet I made that as clear as mud. Did the words make sense?
No. Yes, yes.
Okay. Right.
I understand that totally. Another question from the chat room. We have a very busy chat room tonight, Dwayne.
Cool.
So, yeah. Another question is from Delilah. I know sometimes when we are stressed or overwhelmed, we are sometimes paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And what she means by that is therefore unable to move forward or make decisions. Could that be a freeze?
No, that's really not what we're talking about with this. In this, we're really talking about a physiological reaction where I cannot move physically. Though what she's talking about can actually be a part of a PTSD reaction because cortisol floods your system as a result of stress. And PTSD means post-traumatic stress disorder. So you're going to have cortisol flooding your system. And that flooding the system can impair your brain, especially your hippocampus, to the point that you're not motivated, you're not able to move forward, particularly if you're afraid. Fear can stop you from moving forward. And unless you can release some endorphins into the system to bring down cortisol levels or get the left frontal lobe working to pray or meditate or get some essence of hope, you're going to be stuck there. So she's right, but only as a as a result of the hormonal reaction. But when we're talking about freeze, as far as fight, flight, freeze, we're actually talking about a physiological reaction that I cannot move in the face of the danger.
Mm-hmm. Dwayne?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we just, I had first of all, we probably should mention that if anybody would like to call in with a question, in addition to the chat room, you can reach Dwayne at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. And there was another question in the chat room about the term freeze. Is that something fairly new? Has that term been around a while?
No, I
hadn't heard it before tonight.
Yeah, no, it's been around for a while. Most people are recognize the fight or flight response, I would say for the last 10 years or so, people have been researchers and therapists have been including the freeze component. One thing to understand about the field of trauma is that since the Vietnam War, about that era, trauma has really just changed and changed and changed. The research has just taught us more and more and more about trauma, and once we realized the connection between body and mind and how that all works together, then trauma just literally blossomed as a field. So a lot of things have kind of happened in the last 10 or so years. The problem is that with our diagnostic tool that we use, it's called the DSM. It's a book that we use to make diagnosis. PTSD hasn't been updated since like 1980-something, so it's not in the book yet. A new book is coming out in 2012. It'll be the DSM-5, and so that will have updated information. So what I'm saying is the tool we use to diagnose with still is kind of antiquated, and it may not. It's not in there. But if you go to any kind of training, any kind of seminar, any kind of conference on trauma, freeze is part of that response, fight, flight, freeze.
Okay, thank you. And so Kim and I usually, the cases we profile on Seeking Justice, are incidents of where... And it tends to be generally where we're talking about a young adult or possibly a child.
Okay.
Dies. And the cause and manner of death are attributed to accident or suicide, where there is quite a bit of evidence, actually, that perhaps it was a homicide, okay? And maybe there was an inadequate investigation by the authorities or that type of thing. We have other cases where we have clearly homicides, but the cases go cold. No one is arrested. And, again, sometimes it's maybe just a very proficient killer, or maybe there's some question about the investigation of the case. Now, I was just curious, when obviously losing a child is difficult at any stage.
Right.
But to lose a child to an accident or suicide, and you don't think as a parent or a loved one, you don't believe it was truly an accident or suicide. So you have the loss of the person, And on top of that, you have the possibility that someone is getting away with murder.
Right.
I'm just trying to, that's just got to be a very difficult thing to deal with. I mean, dealing with a loss, if it was through natural causes, would be difficult enough.
Mm-hmm.
But when you add this other element to it, that, you know, you're fighting the system, trying to get the case reopened or trying to get somebody
right.
to take a second look, you've also lost your loved one and so forth. Am I correct that is just more pressure on the survivor?
It is, and it has to be processed differently. In other words, if it was an accident, I process it in a different way than I would process it if it was a homicide or a suicide. They're all traumatic, and I will have a traumatic reaction to all three of them. But I process the information differently. I remember I worked with a woman who was a single mom. She had two little girls, and her apartment caught fire. One of the little girls nearly died in the fire, but she survived. And the mom started coming for counseling support because she knew she needed it. And we were working together for about a month when the police determined that the fire was purposely set by her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, actually. Well, this woman who had worked for a month thinking this was accidental and had been working through the trauma as an accident, literally had to start all over because this was a whole new event for her. The event changed dramatically. It was just a whole new event that she had to process differently because now it was someone tried to kill her child, not her child nearly died as a result of an accident. So the processing that I have to go through is different. I'm traumatized by all three, but the way I process it is going to be different because of many factors, but not the least of which is this was not accidental. It was intentional, and I have to process intent differently than accident. Does that make sense? Do the words make sense?
Yes, I understand, mm-hmm. I think. And another question, I think along the same lines, let's take a suicide mm-hmm. Finding or determination by the authorities as for the death, and let's assume it is an actual suicide.
Okay.
What does something like that do to the parent? Is it liable to put them on a guilt trip saying, well, what could have been so bad? You know,
oh, absolutely.
Is it something I did? That type of thing.
Absolutely. In fact, you're going to find there's guilt. Whenever a parent lives longer, outlives their child, and the child died as a result of a sudden death, non-medical, you're going to find that parent experiencing some level of guilt. One of the things we have to do, whenever there's an event that we have no control over, human beings must put accountability somewhere. And some will put it on God, some will put it on, you know, the first person on the scene. But most of the time with parents, there will be some process of what could I have done differently so this would not have happened. And, you know, there may have been nothing they could have done, but they will still ask the question. And so, yes, there will always be, whether it's suicide, whether it's homicide, whether it's accident, there will always be a part of that parent. And, you know, I don't think it ever completely goes away. I think a good therapist can work with them to a degree to help them understand that there was nothing they could do or whatever. But I think there will always be just a wisp of a question about, but what if? And that's human nature to do that. So absolutely. And then when it's another point I want to make to suicide, when a child completes the act of suicide, the statistics say 85 to 90% of the time the parents will divorce within the first 3 years. A child's suicide almost always ends the marriage of the parents. Particularly if they don't get some kind of mental health support to help keep them together. And a lot of that has to do with, I'm blaming myself, but I also am going to put a little blame on you. And, you know, you could have done something different too. And so that statistic is just incredibly high for a child that completes suicide for the parents.
Did you say it was, what, 85 to 90%?
85 to 90 is the last thing I read in one of the journals. Yeah.
That's staggering. I mean,
Well, it's high if a child dies a traumatic death. It's like 60%. But for suicide, it goes way up.
Wow. Dwayne, before we move on any further and I turn it back over to Kim, I was just thinking, do you have any website information you'd like to give out someone would like to?
Sure. My website is www.dwaynetbowers.com. I'll spell that, DuaneTBowers. So www.dwaynetbowers.com. And my email address is dtbowers@att.net. And people are welcome to contact me. I love to answer questions about trauma. That's what I do.
Okay. What was that email again?
Email is D as in Dwayne, T as in Thomas, Bowers, Bowers. So let me do that again. dtbowers@att.net.
Okay. I'm just putting that in our chat room for folks to
Kim?
Access. Yes.
Hey, this is Sarah. I was just
wondering. Hi, Sarah.
Hey. Hello, Mr. Bowers.
Hi, how are you?
My name is Sarah Teague. I have a daughter that's been missing. Her name is Heather. She's been missing since August the 26th of 1995.
Okay.
And I know, I think I read for you do have a book called A Child is Missing or something.
Yes. Yeah, A Child is Missing, Supporting Families of Missing Children. Actually, you can get it through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and it's free. You go to the website.
What exactly do you do with a suicide or a car accident or even a murder or whatever, you know, you get to have the honor to bury your child and to say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't know where your child is and you searched, you know, my search has been going on over 14 years now.
Absolutely.
And what I find is that people absolutely do not know what to do with you.
yeah.
I mean, they really don't. I met this lady that I haven't seen in years. I used to keep her two kids in the nursery, and we kind of hooked back up on Facebook, and she told me yesterday that she could no longer be my friend. She didn't want to. It's like she thinks I have this black cloud over me or something, and I found that throughout the years, and I don't believe it's anything malicious on anybody's part, except people honestly do not know what to do with you when you just don't know where your child is. And if you keep looking past a certain year, it's like you haven't given it to God, and you should quit. In fact, she told me, she said, why don't you get you a bench, plant you a flower, say goodbye. And I'm like, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't say goodbye.
Right.
You know, because I haven't been given that honor and dignity to know if Heather, you know, isn't alive.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about working with folks with missing children or missing family members is most work is done with a person after the trauma is over. That's why we call it post-traumatic stress disorder. What people don't get is while the child is still missing, that trauma is still going on. It's not over. It's not post. And unfortunately, many people in the mental health field don't get that either. And I have heard so many parents of missing children say, well, I went to a therapist, but all they wanted to talk about was grieving and letting them go.
Yes, exactly. We don't get to grieve. We don't have that. I call it honor and dignity. We're not blessed with that day the day that Heather was born. I have that day. Well, I want a date that she took her last breath, if indeed she has.
Right.
And don't you think, and don't all of y'all think that this thing with J.C. Dugard has absolutely turned the not knowing world upside down?
Sure.
I mean, it is just an amazing, you know, something that has happened. And I just hope and pray that it makes people that do know realize that there are people out there today that have been abducted and they're still alive.
Absolutely. And parents like you who have a child who's been missing for so long, and tell me if this is true, what I have found is most parents think in terms of, okay, here's what I'm going to do if she comes back, and here's what I'm going to do if she doesn't. In other words, you sort of, anytime you think about the future, you see it in two ways. Is that true for you?
Well, all I know is at first I kept saying, you know, Heather will be home before this Christmas. We will have our answers. And, for instance, this past year in November, I had a receipt brought to me with Heather's name printed on it, Heather Tigg. The man described Heather, said she went on the Internet, it was her. And then in December, we had a search for her remains coming from another lead. And it was in January that we finally figured out that the Heather Tigg is in my other daughter Holly's nursing class. So we tracked that lead down. But for a few months there, you know, it was, okay, Heather was seen at this restaurant. She's passing through. Okay, she is alive. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I went and sat at the restaurant. And, mm-hmm. and you know, just things like that, even after, you know, almost 14 years. And like I say, then in December, you know, I had organized a search for the surrounding properties. And so it's this continual, it's just this not knowing.
Absolutely.
You know, has she been sold? And there's some more people on the Peace for Missing. I wouldn't take anything in the world for that website. That has given me more support, and, you know, you get to finally hear somebody else say what they're doing during the day and how they're feeling every day and all the what ifs. That has been the biggest blessing.
Excellent.
For me.
Excellent. And I have heard that from many parents where the only people who get it are other people in the same situation. There are organizations like Project Jason that has I think you call it blog, but it's a website where people talk to each other through the computer, and they're all parents or not even parents. Some of them have missing adults as well.
Mm-hmm.
Team
yeah,
Hope,
Patty Wetterling, Jason's mom. Yes.
Patty Wetterling started. She started Team Hope, and Team Hope is still now part of National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It's a phone support line, and the people who are on the phone are parents of missing children, and they've been trained to provide support to other parents of missing children. So,
well, believe me, nobody else has a clue. I mean, nobody else has a clue. They don't know.
Yep, and that's again that idea that the trauma is still going on. Think of it, Kim and Danny, think of this. What isn't the thought of searching for your daughter's remains and going out and doing it? Isn't that a traumatic event? I mean, her trauma is that her child is missing, and look at the traumatic events that keep happening in this bigger traumatic event of the missing child, and. So there's no end to it, and that's what makes it unique.
I've climbed up oil tanks and looked in oil tanks. I've dug in ditches with my bare hands. Mm. I have opened refrigerators during the first couple of weeks or first couple of days that Heather was missing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just, I mean, it's unbelievable the things that you will do without even thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've always been afraid of heights, and I climbed that oil tank faster than anybody could even catch me,
mm-hmm.
and it was when I got to the top and knew that I had to open that lid. And I heard people down below, my good friends, just talking like it was, you know, well, Heather was so tiny, she could fit in there. Well, oil preserves the body, another person said. And there I was at the top of this oil tank, beating everybody up there. I mean, I made sure I was the one that got up there.
And
then I had to open that lid to look down and see if Heather's hair was floating in that oil tank.
But you also wanted to be the one
find
her.
I wasn't afraid of heights anymore. If I walk up bleachers right now, I might get dizzy, but I didn't that day. I went right up there, and I would do it again. You know, you go wherever you have to go and do whatever you have to do, and that's just the way it is when you're a mom.
Ms. Tiggs, I'm so glad that you're on here because
you're
expressing the things that. I could tell those things, but it certainly wouldn't be coming from my experience. So thank you for sharing that, because I know that's painful even to share that stuff. So I appreciate that you're able to do that.
I've kept a journal since day 16, and that's been my kind of, I guess, therapy because,
mm-hmm.
like you say, I've gone to, I mean, I'm not on any medication at all, and I know I've talked to a lot of, you know, mothers that have missing kids that they are, and you know, I haven't gone for any counseling. I know I probably should, but you know, it would take another person that knows.
Yeah.
And you don't have a clue unless you've been here.
Yeah. Absolutely. You have to shop for a good therapist who gets it. Absolutely. Yeah.
And some of the ways that we can choose a mental health professional. You know, you can do different things. It doesn't guarantee as to the ability of the therapist, but
right.
What are some of the ways that people can, in this situation, in Sarah's situation, there are so many like her listening tonight.
I would interview, and I say this to everybody, no matter what their background is, interview that therapist on the telephone before you make the appointment. And if they're not willing to do that, that's a good sign that you need to move on. No one should expect that someone's going to buy you sight unseen. And I always spend time with a new client on the telephone answering whatever questions they have. And if they don't know what to ask, I kind of help them with the questions. So first of all, will they spend time with you before you ever make an appointment? Then you should ask them, what is their experience in trauma, and what techniques do they use for trauma? Now, you're not going to find too many mental health folks that have had experience in missing children, so mm-hmm. your best bet is just looking at trauma. If they've been trained in traumatic incident reduction, if they've been trained in EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, let's see, what's a couple of others? Gradual exposure therapy. If they can name a specific trauma technique that they use and they've been using it for several years, well, that's a good indicator.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a start. And then, as you're talking, are you comfortable with them, or do they keep interrupting you? And if they keep interrupting you on the phone, guess what they're going to do in the session, you know? And do they keep telling you about all their credentials? Well, I'll bet uh-huh. you that if you walk into their office, every award they've ever gotten is on the wall, you know? And that's the center, not the chairs. The chairs should be the center. So just let your instincts kind of guide you in that first telephone chat. And if you don't feel comfortable, don't even ask yourself why. Just say thank you for your time and move to the next one and make another mm-hmm. phone call.
Well, Mr. Byers, what do you do about this nasty little hormone cortisol? I have put on about 40 pounds. And I'm, you know, tell me, I mean, is there some anti-cortisol you can take?
Well, I'll tell you, cortisol, like I said, is a hormone, and
mm-hmm.
it can be reduced by endorphins. Now, endorphins are released, as everybody knows, through exercise. They're also released through chocolate, feeling good about yourself. I don't know how careful I have to be in what I say, but sex releases endorphins. releasing endorphins is the most natural way to do it. And understand that what I'm about to say, I am not prescribing and I'm not telling you to take this. I'm just
mm-hmm.
telling you about an article I read in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, suggested that vitamin C, ginseng, and omega-3 fatty acids actually help to reduce the level of cortisol in the system. Now, again, don't take that stuff because I said it. You talk to your doctor before you ever take anything, even over the counter. But
mm-hmm.
so there are some things, and if you do some research, just do some research about cortisol, you'll find that there are some things. There's a lot of research out there now on cortisol and how to bring those levels down. And the cortisol does strange things to you. Let me just tell you a couple of other things. It's tied to type 2 diabetes. It's tied to – well, the cortisol's real function in your body is to age you. It is the aging hormone. That's its role. It's to make you older. So people who have post-traumatic stress disorder and who've had it for a long period of time, their body ages much more quickly than people who don't, because there's more cortisol in their body. And it's like I said, it's tied to type 2 diabetes. It's tied to that role of central body fat that everybody develops later in life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's there and it functions even when we don't want it to. If you know what progeria is a a malady, I guess I'll call it, of children, where a child may be 10.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a child may be 10, but they look like they're 40. And that's because of the super high levels of cortisol in their system. So that's its role. Now, let me tell you what it does for trauma. It floods your system when you are traumatized, and it does two things. Number one, it shuts down your immune system because your body decides, okay, I'm dealing with trauma. I don't need to waste energy fighting a cold right now. The other role of cortisol is when the trauma's over, it's supposed to tell your body, shut down. Trauma's over. Go back to normal. But if I have flashbacks, dreams, nightmares, I can't get the pictures out of my head, I'm still afraid, I keep pumping out the cortisol, and it keeps flooding my system. And so there's no stopping it. And that's what happens when people suffer from PTSD. They have these extremely high levels of cortisol. Cortisol can result in high levels of cortisol results in depression. After it affects your brain for a while, it actually starts to atrophy part of your brain. So there's a long answer to a short question again. I'm sorry.
I opened a Pandora's box, didn't I?
That's a wonderful, I didn't know anything about that cortisol. But I do want to say that the second Keys to Healing retreat will take place on August 13th through the 15th, 2010. And this retreat and all it offers is the best life training offered anywhere for persons living with the ambiguous loss of a child or adult loved one. And I did just post the Project Jason website, and that information about the retreat is on that website. And
I was just going to say, who have you been talking to?
That is such an important, I've not been there, but I've heard from those who have been, and it's something that, Sarah, I hope that you can.
I wanted to go this year so badly, but I didn't get to, but I'm going to get there next year.
Good.
I need that.
I facilitated this year's, and I will facilitate next year's as well. So that's why I was surprised you knew about it. So.
Excellent. Also, I did want to ask about something you had touched on before when you talked about putting the accountability somewhere and blaming ourselves or blaming someone else.
Yeah.
When when you blame yourself, it's really akin to guilt, putting a big guilt trip on yourself. When and how does someone get over that?
You know, I've known people who never do and who go on blaming themselves for years and years. I think you really do need help with that. And I don't necessarily mean counseling help, but somebody who can help you talk that through. You know, the worst thing that can happen is you go to a friend and say, I feel so guilty, and the friend goes, oh, you have nothing to feel guilty about. Well, what they're telling you is, I don't want to deal with this. So you really have to let a person flesh it out. And you know, sometimes there might have been something that they could have done different, and maybe the result would have been different. With suicide, I hear this more and more, where a husband or wife, usually a wife, will say, you know, I'd seen this so many times. He'd stop taking his meds, and then he'd start on that downward spiral and get more and more into his depression. And usually I'd just throw him in the car and get him to the hospital, and they'd monitor his meds for a couple of days and send him home. This time I just waited until the next morning, and unfortunately he took his life that night. And so she goes to her friends and she says, I feel so guilty. And the friends go, oh, you have nothing to feel guilty about. Well, there is a little bit of guilt there. The guilt is simply, had she gone the night before, he might still be alive. But she did not kill him. And so when we're talking about guilt, there may be a little piece in there that the person could have done something, but that's all they're responsible for. So when you're working with guilt, the best way to work with it is to say, okay, let's look at it. And if there's a little bit here that maybe you could have done something different, let's work with it, but let's get rid of all the other stuff that you're holding yourself accountable for, because you had nothing to do with any of that. Did that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So people are going to feel guilty. And in fact, I got to tell you, when the death is as a result of an accident, people must place accountability somewhere. They'll start off by saying, I don't blame anybody, but I guarantee you they have to lay blame somewhere for an accident, regardless of what kind of accident it is. And this just gives me a sense of control. If I can find something that I could have done different that would have changed this, then it was controllable and I can wrap around it a little better. Mm-hmm. As long as I feel it's totally out of control, I can't cope with it very well. I can't integrate it into myself. If I can find one little thing that could have been different, there it is. That's the key. Had that happened, this wouldn't have happened. So, yeah. And I think for a lot of people, they really do need some help just fleshing that out. And it can be a good friend. It can be a pastor. It can be just somebody who's willing to spend time and talk to them about, okay, let's look at it. Let's look at what part might have been different if you'd done something different. And the most important thing is to be validated and let somebody hear you. And if that person will say, yes, I hear you, I understand why you're feeling that way. Wow. That's the biggest help you could be.
Yep.
Ms. Teague, were you going to say something?
I just totally agree with that, because it's not often that you are heard. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It's different hearing somebody's voice talking to you. You know, that's, I guess, what I long for. But, you know, I settle and I do find peace, you know, talking to other, you know, on the internet or whatever I can get. But, I think that would be wonderful. It is wonderful to be validated.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, J.C. Dugard came home on Heather's anniversary and I didn't find out about it until the next day. And people kept saying, oh, doesn't that give you hope? And remember, I was on the radio show that next day, I think, and I was like, hope? What kind of hope is that? And I had to go through. I mean, it took me days to work through, and I'm still having, you know, some problems with it. But I think about a week later, I heard that JC's mama was brushing JC's hair. And it finally hit me, you know,
mm-hmm.
I cannot even imagine, you know, brushing Heather's hair.
Mm-hmm.
And so it put all of that that I was feeling, you know, in a different place. I mean, I wouldn't want Heather to have gone through anything, and I'm sorry that JC had to, but I do know that what happened to her is going to make a difference in some things.
You know, I just was at a training for Team Hope, and they got to go to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and see the offices and see all of the forensics things that goes on there. And while they were there, JC's mom called and just chatted with them.
Oh.
And I got to debrief them afterwards, and there was all these people who were saying, you know, I felt such joy that her child was found, and I felt so angry that it wasn't mine, and then I felt guilty for feeling angry because, you know, and I can only imagine the multitude of feelings people like you, Ms. Teague, go through when you hear somebody.
Envious.
Yeah.
I had a good friend that found her son after, I think, 5 years, and she went on top of a mountain and picked up one of his bones.
Mm-hmm.
And the day that I heard that Jeffrey had been found, I was like, thank God that he's home. And I called Linda, and we talked, and I told her, I said, oh, I just ache. I said, how does it feel? How does it feel,
yeah.
You know, to finally be able to say goodbye? And then when she told me she had one of his bones in her top drawer, I mean, it was just like, wow. What do you say? What do you say to that? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just so many emotions. You know, the envy and of course you're just so thankful that somebody's home. You know.
Yeah.
No matter how they've come home, at least you know that they're home. And people, you know, I was saying how they don't know what to do with you. I have ribbons that I say Heather is coming home, and people will just, you know, that. I hope it's not malicious. I choose to believe it's not. They'll say, what is wrong with her? You know, don't she know her little girl's dead? She's sitting there waiting for her to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't realize what I mean. You know, of course, I hope she walks through the door. But if she doesn't, I want her.
You still want her to come home.
I want to know that she's been home, or,
yep.
You know.
Yep. Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I think part of why people, and I agree with you, I don't think they're trying to be malicious, but I think it's what you said at the beginning. People don't know what to do with you.
They really don't.
They don't know how to support you. They don't know. And the easiest thing for them to say is, well, you know, suck it up and get over it. Because you're making them so uncomfortable, they have to run.
That's exactly right.
And it's unfortunate, but the bottom line is you need to survive. And how you are surviving, the best way to survive for you is to find others who get it, who've been in that situation. Yeah.
That's it right there.
Yeah. Denny, did I hear you?
Yes, I have two questions. One is, I just saw in the chat room a few minutes ago, somebody had a question about trauma being a precursor to fibromyalgia or lupus.
That's an interesting question.
I have a follow-up question about support groups. So do you want to take the fibromyalgia lupus question first?
Yeah, I'll take that first, and there's not a lot I can say about it other than I read a lot of trauma journals, and that's what I focus on is trauma journals. And there is a lot of research being done about the connection between trauma and fibromyalgia. The common thread is the cortisol. So there's a lot of research. There's a lot out there that suggests that there is a connection between the two. Also, stress. Remember that trauma is a form of, quote, anxiety, which is a form of stress. So any stress will release cortisol. So they're really looking at that. And here's another thing I've read about. They're really trying to do some connecting between the idea of trauma and cortisol and Alzheimer's later in life. There's a lot of research out there that's trying to support that connection, and right now it's looking like it's going that direction. People also ask about ADHD and the connection between perhaps prenatal trauma, which is a whole other field, and early childhood trauma and ADHD, and so there's some research along those lines as well going on. It's not definitive. There's not an answer yet, but there's sure enough out there that's making you think, you know what, there could be a connection here. So that was a very good question. Now, I don't know about lupus. I've not read about that. So I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying I haven't read about it. But I have certainly read articles that are trying to make that connection with the others. Support groups for PTSD?
Well, I was thinking about for the support groups I had in mind were for people who have lost children.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I don't know. There are several groups I'm aware of around, and I'm sure there might have different structures. I don't know how many have professional therapist types or counselors, and I know at least one that's just a group of people who have lost children. There's no professional in the group. And I just wanted to hear your thoughts, if you would, on support groups. Do they serve a valuable purpose? How long should you stay in a support group? That type of thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yes, I do believe support groups are very valuable, no matter what your issue is, whether it is trauma, whether it's any number of things, because just knowing that other people are having a similar experience to you reduces the level of anxiety so much you no longer feel, oh, my God, there's something wrong with me. You can start hearing that other people are experiencing similar things, and then you also get to hear how they're dealing with it, and maybe they've got a way of dealing with it that you hadn't thought of and that sort of thing. That's just general support groups. There are, and I don't know how you really want to look at them, but there are national organizations like Parents of Murdered Children, which isn't – I would call that sort of a big support group. I mean, they have chapters all over the country, and they have a national convention. And they, when they get together, they provide speakers along certain fields. But the point more than that is just being with other people who get it and who have been in the experience and understand what it's like. And just that, and you've heard Ms. Teague say it, just that alone can be so helpful, that I'm not alone in this and that other people understand. I don't even have to explain what I'm feeling right now. They get it because they've been there. So I think, yes, they're very powerful, very helpful. And that's kind of what like Team Hope does, the telephone support. It's not a support group, but it's one-to-one kind of support too. And Project Jason and all of those other, I mean, there's many, many organizations out there that provide that online kind of support as well. So, you know, there's articles saying that the support group is a thing of the past, and now support is a function of the Internet. And more and more people are turning to the Internet for that support, just like Ms. Teague said. And the advantage to that, now I'm not saying I buy into that 100%, but the advantage to that is people who live way out in the country who need support and don't have access to mental health or to support groups or whatever can get online and find support. So, you know, there's the argument to be said that maybe the online support is going to replace, you know, support groups in the future. Who knows? And again, there was a long answer to a short question.
I'm sorry. Denny, were you okay? I just don't know where to begin. I do want to say that we do have a lot of retreat folks in the chat room, and they all want to say hi to Dwayne.
Hi to all of them. They're such great people. I want to make this statement, and I meant to make this statement at the beginning. Parents of missing children particularly, but people who have a missing family member are some of the most amazingly resilient and strong people I have ever, ever, ever met. The ability, I can't imagine what it takes to put a foot in front of the other with a child or a family member missing. And to see the work that some of these folks do, they create their own foundations, they go out and help others in their search, they help support each other. It is amazing the strength that these folks have. And then I also want to acknowledge that there are folks who aren't out doing that. They can't get out to do that. They haven't found the strength yet to do that. And unfortunately, they're not getting services because they're not able to get out to them. But I got to tell you, if you were to ever get into a group of parents of missing children, you'd be amazed at the strength and the resilience that is exhibited by these folk. It is amazing. So hi to all those folks from the retreat. It's good to know they're all there.
Well, they are, and Maureen says hello, and she says that the retreat was great. So
great.
Everybody looks like everybody's here tonight. so glad to have you here with us. Well, we're down to our 2 minutes. Denny, do you have any other questions or anything else that you'd like to ask?
Well, just a comment, really. Dwayne, I really want to thank you. It's been very informative and very enjoyable, and I hope if we extend an invitation to you in the future, you'll consider coming back with us.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. Thank you, Denny.
Okay. And Mrs. Teague, thank you very much for your phone call and participating
with us. Thank you
all
so much. Thanks, Kim, for inviting me on the Peace Floor. And Mr. Bowers, I will be in touch with you and emailing you some things. And just,
excellent.
Just thanks. That's all I know to say is just thank you all.
Well, again, for me too, Dwayne, thank you so much. I learned so much tonight, things that I was not aware of, and I just can't thank you enough for coming on the show. And thank you, Mrs. Teagues, and thank you, Denny, and everybody in the chat room. You guys are wonderful. And that's it. Good night, and God bless.
Bye-bye.
Good night, y'all.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.